The next part of this workshop is about describing what child abuse really is. The reason why I'm going to go through talking to you about what child abuse is because most of us do not have a clear understanding of what it actually is. Most of us only understand child abuse in terms of abject child abuse, stuff that if anybody saw, they would know it was abusive. But when a person has codependency issues, you will find that their issues of abuse oftentimes are very covert or hidden, very subtle, or the abuse they experienced was culturally considered okay when it just simply is abuse. Just because something culturally is considered acceptable does not mean that it isn't abusive to a child. When something is experienced as abusive for a child, what that means is that the experience shames the child. It's almost irrelevant whether the culture thinks it's abusive or not. All that really matters in terms of codependency recovery is that it is acknowledged to the codependent that what happened was abusive because it was, because it shamed them. Now, I talk about abuse under four different labels: physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, and spiritual intellectual abuse. The first one, physical abuse, is actually about how the major caretakers treated the child's body. Was it treated with respect, or was it attacked or ignored, or both? The first kind of abuse I have on this list here is called abject abuse. That is abuse that obviously is considered illegal. It's anybody can recognize abject abuse. It's things like a child being scalded or burned on purpose, a child having their hands cut off, cigarette burns put on their genitals, linear fractures of the skull, contused or lacerated internal organs from punching. That kind of thing is not only abusive, it's called abject abuse, and in addition to that, it's illegal. But there are many other forms of physical abuse that do need to be talked about. And again, the bottom line about this is whether it is in regard to the attitude of the parent towards the child's body. If the attitude of the parent was that of respect, then likely you have a shaming process going on and an issue of abuse. Now, I want to say just one side note about respect. One of the things I've noticed in our culture is that I hear a lot of parents demanding respect from children. You know, I don't get no respect. My answer to any parent saying that to me, and the answer I give myself too when I'm being confronted with that by my children, is that, you know, it's not the responsibility of the child to respect the parent. It is the responsibility of the parent to respect the child and teach the child in turn by modeling that to be respectful of other people, including themselves. To disrespect a child but demand them to respect you is emotionally abusive, period. Now, these other kinds of abuse I consider abusive because of the shaming process that goes on when this happens. Anytime a child is subjected to being attacked with an implement, physical abuse is going on, whether it's a belt or a hairbrush or a chair or a piano leg or a shoe or whatever, wooden spoon, a fly swatter, or whatever. Whenever that kind of thing is going on, likely abuse is going on because it's very shaming. It's inappropriate to attack a child with an implement. First of all, when you do that, you have no idea of how much pain you're inflicting. If your parents did it to you, they had no way of knowing how much they were hurting and shaming you because they couldn't feel it. What's appropriate in terms of discipline, because children do need to be disciplined. I don't believe in anarchy existing within the family. Children need to follow rules and they need discipline. But it needs to be done with a flat hand on a covered bottom. Flat hand, because when you do that, you can feel when you're hurting them too much because you're going to start hurting. Covered bottom, so that you're not stripping and exposing the child and shaming them sexually by pulling their pants down. Flat hand on a covered bottom, or when they're real young, tapping and spanking their hands when they're putting their hands where you don't want them, is appropriate discipline. And by the way, as a child gets older, physical discipline works less and less. I had somebody confront me the other day, well, you know, my 10-year-old will not respond to me. You know, I have to beat him so hard to get him to respond. I said, how old? 10 years old. I said, hey, man, you need to stop that. The older they get, the less they'll respond, you know, and they'll get so they can really resist and endure. And when they get about 13 or 14, if they're getting as big as you are, they're going to start attacking you because that's what you're teaching them. There comes a point when you have to shift from physical discipline into talking to a child about what's going on and having consequences that they get to experience that are related to whatever it is that they rule they were breaking. So if they're out late, you don't beat them. You say, tomorrow night, you're not going to go out. You know, that's what functional parents do. Face slapping is also particularly productive of the shaming process and highly, highly, highly physically abusive. I think face slapping is one of the worst kinds of physical abuse. Hair pulling, head banging. Tickling a child into hysteria also is considered highly physically abusive. Now, what I mean by tickling a child is to tickle them to the point where they wet their pants, they're screaming hysterically or crying hysterically or laughing hysterically. What you're doing is the person doing that is taking control of the body and of the child's body and trashing it. It's like, I'm God of the family. I can do whatever I want. I'm going to lay you down on the floor. I'm going to tickle you into hysteria, and I have the right to do that. When a parent is doing that, they're playing God or goddess of the family. It's inappropriate. Oftentimes, it's a very sneaky way. Sexually inappropriate people are actually sexually abusing their children. Because sometimes it shifts from physical abuse and a parent just simply discharging a lot of anger on into sexual abuse, because the parent is sexually stimulating themselves by doing that to their child. Sometimes that goes on. Also, in terms of beating and physical abuse, often it isn't unusual for some people that are out of control with their sexuality to beat their child, not as an issue of punishment even, but as an issue of sexually stimulating themselves. There are such things as physical beatings that are sexual physical beatings and as a form of physical sexual abuse, incest. Because the parent is stimulating themselves sexually by beating their children. And it's about a ritualized beating when that happens. There's something real special about that kind of beating, and it's about it being very systematic, very structured, and very repetitive, and very open, and very aggressive, and very unpredictable. Another thing that's physically abusive to a child is to not get appropriate physical nurturing. Physical nurturing, which I mentioned was one of the dependency needs, is about a child experiencing hugging, holding, rocking, patting, walking close to, that sort of thing. This lack of appropriate physical nurturing as an issue of physical abuse is seen in the extreme, usually, where a child does not get enough physical nurturing. The message from the family is, I don't want to touch you. Don't touch me, and everybody's kind of cold and nobody touches. Or on the other end of the extreme, there's too much touching, too much holding, too much enmeshment physically. Now, when kids are little babies, they need a whole lot of that hands-on touching. But as the child ages, they need less and less. If the parent doesn't start reducing that intense physical nurturing and keeps it up, they're going to start physically enmeshing with their children and overwhelming them, actually physically abusing them. A child that has experienced that is a child that goes, oh my gosh, here comes mom, she's gonna kiss me, let me get away from her, she's just too much. And that's about the child experiencing that kind of inappropriate physical nurturing. It's an issue of physical abuse. Watching or listening to physical abuse done to another family member or another peer is also physically abusive. If you might have been one of these good little, perfect little adult type kids that never got in trouble, but you watched the snot being beaten out of your brother on a routine basis because he rebelled, and you had to sit and listen to that thumping and that screaming, or you actually had to watch it because dad would line everybody up and make the kids watch each other get beaten. That is very, very, very physically abusive and inappropriate behavior. Also, intrusive procedures oftentimes are experienced as abusive. Two things here I want to point out. One is when a child is very ill a lot and winds up having to go to the doctor or medical people and gets intruded upon a lot. Sometimes just that unintentional but constant intrusive experiences can cause a child to feel shamed. And what I'm talking about now is a whole bunch of shots that are painful and torturing, a lot of examinations of being stripped and looked at and poked and prodded, that sort of thing. On the other hand, the other thing I want to talk about has to do with the use of enemas. When you give a child an enema, it needs to be done very, very carefully. They only need a small amount of water, or whatever you're using. It needs to be given very slowly. And the child's privacy really needs to be respected. So whenever a child is receiving an enema, they are automatically getting a set up for probably a shaming experience, unless the parent really knows what they're doing. What I ask people to do that I'm working with them is to, if they have received a lot of enemas as a kid, to check that out as an issue of abuse. If it was given so it was extremely painful, or if it was given and you were exposed a lot and shamed about it, then you got an issue of abuse. Some parents actually wind up using an enema to keep their child from being needy. It's like every time they have a fever or they complain they're sick, they get an enema, and the enema hurts. And it's a way to say, don't be needy. You be needy, I'll hurt you. On a conscious level, sometimes it's just lack of just any knowledge of appropriate parenting, but the message still to the kid is that it's unsafe to be needy and don't be sick. But sometimes you can move into an area of where the parent is ritualistically trying to hurt their child and torture them through enemas, and it can move on into another area of abuse called physical sexual abuse, where the parent is actually incesting their children through the use of enemas, because what's going on is that they're administering the enemas to the child in order to sexually stimulate themselves. So there's a whole gamut of abuse in terms of physical sexual abuse and some emotional abuse that is actually seen through the use of enema. So I encourage anybody I'm working with to take a look at the use of enemas. This can be just an amazingly abusive area, fertile area to do a lot of therapy around. Also, if you had a parent that was just focused on your bowel movements, and they were constantly in there looking at them, talking to you about them, wondering if you had one, giving you prune juice and laxatives and sneaking around about that, like giving you a milkshake and sneaking a lot of laxatives in it or something like that. So you had a lot of pain in your abdomen because mom was always trying to clean it out. You got an issue of abuse. That's inappropriate. Unintentional, but inappropriate. Okay. The next kind of abuse I want to talk about is sexual abuse, and there's four different kinds of abusive issues in here I want to talk about. The first one is called physical sexual abuse. With physical sexual abuse, there's direct hands-on physical activity with the child. This involves having intercourse with the child, anal sex, oral sex, masturbation, where the child is asked to masturbate an adult, or the adult masturbates the child. And the last one has to do with sexual hugging, kissing, and touching. Sexual touching is known as fondling. All these activities, when a child is subjected to these kinds of activities, physical sexual abuse is going on. It's hands-on direct touching. When it's done by a family member, it's called incest. When it's done by a non-family member, it's called child molestation. Let's be really clear with that. It's called child molestation. A child is a child from birth to 17. This is a big form of sexual abuse. And the bottom line that I use as a guideline when I'm working with someone who has experienced this kind of abuse is that whenever an adult is sexual with a child, sexual abuse is going on. It is never and will never be about the child. It is about the adult. And the adult's lack of a sexual boundary, and could even be about an issue called sex addiction for the adult. It is never about the child. It will never be about the child. One of the things that I object to strenuously within the therapeutic community is that there are still many people who want to blame the child for this activity. In fact, I was in a workshop, presenting a workshop recently, where I had a therapist talk to me about a child, number one, allowing abuse to happen and setting up themselves to be abused. That is an offender statement. And by the way, if you ever are working with a therapist who says that kind of thing to you, run. Leave the office. You have somebody who does not know how to approach issues of abuse. A child never invites abuse. A child is never responsible for abuse. There are many other underlying dynamics going on, and they're about the parent being out of control and not about the child. Later on, if the child has been just very, very seriously abused, it'll look like they're setting it up. And there are some forms of sexual abuse because we as an animal are set up to respond to sexual stimulation starting at birth. Some forms of sexual abuse actually feel good to the child. You know, if a child is fondled, it may not be that it hurt. It may be that it felt good. The fact that it felt good is still not about the child nor the child's responsibility. It's about the adult being out of control. In fact, when I'm dealing with an adult who has been victimized sexually but the sexual abuse felt good, I am dealing with a person that's more difficult to deal with, because they're going to want to take responsibility for allowing that to happen or letting it happen or letting it continue to happen. What I want to tell you is that it is absolutely never about the victim. It's about boundaries, and the child never has the capacity to intervene on something like that, especially when it's a family member doing it. And because of the shaming experience, they are immobilized, and they will be into a shaming experience whether it feels good or not, whether they're conscious of it or not. So the issue of it feeling good and not being able to stop it, or even asking for it, is still not about the child. It is absolutely about the adult, period. The second kind of sexual abuse is called overt explicit sexual abuse. Now, with this kind of abuse, there's actually two different kinds. One is called voyeurism, and the other is called exhibitionism. Voyeurism in our culture is known as peeping. Exhibitionism in our culture is known as flashing. Interesting thing, several years ago, that flashing was considered so funny. You know, flashing is a level 2 sex addiction, so is voyeurism. This is not funny. Our culture has a way of giving us a message we're not to talk about it, yet it's real blatant and in our face, and when issues of sex addiction are in our faces, we laugh about it. And we think it's funny, or we think it's normal. It's just kooky what we do with our sexuality and our culture. Anyway, voyeurism and exhibitionism are two forms of sexual abuse called overt and explicit sexual abuse. When I'm asking people to inventory whether this happened to them, I say look for two things. Look for this happening outside of your family, but also look for it happening inside the family. Outside of the family, I think you can understand about some not driving up and saying, hey, little girl, or something like that, look at me, and you look in the car and they're flashing their genitals, or there's a peeping Tom outside your bathroom window, your bedroom window. I think you can understand that. Most people can identify that readily. It's when it's done within the family that it isn't identified. When voyeurism and exhibitionism is going on within the family by older family members, like mom or dad or an older brother, an older sister, a cousin, an uncle, or somebody living in the family like that, what's going on is that the person doing this is sexually stimulating themselves in the process of doing that. And there's intent here to sexually abuse the child, even though there's no hands-on touching. It isn't this kind. There's no touching. This is all done without touching. Now, oftentimes, as a person who now is an adult who's experienced this, oftentimes you won't know if this went on, but let me give you some clues about this. If this was going on in your family, you would now have the feeling when I'm talking about this that this could be possible. And when you think back about what happened in your family, you will remember having the sense that when you were dressing or undressing or trying to go to the bathroom or take a shower, you know, be in the bathroom or your bedroom doing private things, that it wasn't safe. That it was, you always had the sense that somebody was going to leap in there and try to stare at you or try to expose themselves to you. It's like, oh, here comes Dad, you know, or something, you know, I don't like seeing him nude. I don't like seeing him do that. I mean, it's like there was some energy Dad was giving off, a mom or an older brother or whatever, that felt unusual and overwhelming, which of course he didn't understand, because children don't understand about that kind of sexual energy and that kind of sexual out-of-control behavior. There are rules set up in the family. They go like this. Nobody is to be private. If you're private, you're a prude. There's no doors on the bathroom, no doors on the bedroom. Everybody should see everybody, and if you have a problem with this, it's your problem. It's not that I'm out of control, it's that you have a problem. And again, the child has a sense of wanting to do this when it's going on, whether a brother or sister or mother or father or Uncle Harry or whatever. So oftentimes with this kind of family, there's nudity in the family. And there's a lot of leering in the family. Okay, this one's a hard one to identify. But it's just as profoundly abusive many times as this stuff up here, the physical sexual abuse. The third kind of sexual abuse I want to talk about is covert sexual abuse. With covert sexual abuse, I would mention two to you. One is verbal and one is about boundaries. Verbal sexual abuse is about two different aspects. One is about inappropriate sexual talk in the family, where there's a lot of sexual innuendos, sexual joking, sexual name calling, sexual grilling of kids after they're dating or doing things like child comes home from a date and dad's at the door and he wants to know everything you did, which is really none of his business at that point. The other kind of verbal sexual abuse has to do with sexual information. This is seen in the extreme. What I would tell you is that all children need information about sexuality. Our sexuality is a very, very powerful drive. Life is about babies anyway. If you haven't figured it out, it's all about babies. If we weren't busy making babies, we would die out as a species within about 120 years. So the whole thing is about making babies when it gets down to the nuts and bolts of it. That means our sexuality and our sexual drive is extremely powerful because it has to be in order for us to survive. If it wasn't, we would start dying out. So children need sexual information about their sexual drive and sexual behavior and sexual expectations. It is abusive to not give them that information and expect them to get it from their peers or the school. It's highly inappropriate. It's nice when it comes from the school. I support school projects and that give sexual information to a child, but the information needs to be coming more from their parents. So it's abusive to a child not to give them information. It also is abusive to give them too much, too soon, and too early. That also is abusive, and that's on the other end of the extreme. On that other end of the extreme, it also is abusive to give them jaded, skewed sexual information, like to tell them they're going to get pregnant if they kiss, or that the reason why they have pimples is because they're masturbating, or that masturbation is evil and sinful. Masturbation is normal. That's how we keep our brains, which are our master sex gland, connected to our bottoms, which is where we act it out. We need to be doing that so we can be sexually functional as an adult. Highly inappropriate to tell a child that to masturbate is abnormal. It is absolutely normal. What a parent needs to be doing is being concerned if the child is doing that obsessively and compulsively and hurting themselves and distressing themselves and that kind of thing. Otherwise, it's nobody's business what the child is doing, and they need protection, and they need privacy, and they need to know that that's normal. The worst thing you can do to a child is tell them not to masturbate, since it's normal. You tell them not to masturbate, for sure you're going to set them up for obsessing and compulsing. It's like me telling you not to think about monkeys. What if I told you in here we're going to spend 10 minutes not thinking about monkeys? You're going to spend 10 minutes trying not to think about monkeys. All the time you're thinking about monkeys, I mean, trying not to think about monkeys, you're going to be concentrating on monkeys. That's what you do when you tell a child not to do something that's normal to be doing, especially something that is as powerful as sexuality. When you combine that with a dysfunctional system that doesn't have sexual boundaries, you're setting the kid up for profoundly dysfunctional behavior. So verbal sexual abuse, which is covert in nature, is about sexual talk and about sexual information. The second thing it is about boundaries, sexual boundaries. Now, with this kind of abuse, there's absolutely no intent to abuse. What this is about is that when a child is raised in a family system, a dysfunctional one, that where the parents do not have appropriate sexual boundaries, what happens is the child grows up without an appropriate boundary because they will mimic what the parent has. And if your parent have two different boundaries, you'll wind up flopping back and forth between each different boundary. Like if you have a mom with a wall of fear for a sexual boundary, so everything is, you know, hide it and run and scream and don't do it. But you have a father that has none and he's wide open running around the house doing all kinds of things. The child winds up usually bouncing back and forth as an adult between both systems. Either they're scared to death or they're wide open. That's abusive. That's abusive. They need an appropriate, well-formed sexual boundary, which I'll talk about later. This is unintentional at all. The parent can only demonstrate what they have. They can't do anything else but demonstrate what they have. So there's no intent here at all. A functional family system will demonstrate sexual boundaries by doing these kinds of things. A functional family will demonstrate a boundary because the adults do not have sex or engage in overt sexual behavior in front of their kids. They're not about French kissing each other in the living room. They're not about petting on the couch. They're not about having sex with their bedroom door open or so loud it comes through the walls and the vents. They protect the children from the nature and the sounds of their sexual behavior. Also, functional parents don't walk around the house nude or in their underwear after the child is aware of differences between mom and dad. They also don't allow their children to sleep with them. And they allow the child and teach the child how to have privacy when they're going to the bathroom, dressing, or bathing. That what happens with this is that within the functional family, of course, the child needs to be taught how to go to the bathroom, bathe, dress, and they need a lot of assistance with that. As soon as they can do it on their own, they're allowed to do it on their own, in the bathroom or wherever, with the door open. Later on, they're asked to shut the door, and later on, they're told to shut and lock the door, that is appropriate wherever they are when they're doing that, to model that boundary. And that's how people wind up developing appropriate sexual boundaries within the functional system. A dysfunctional system, within a dysfunctional system, the parents will do this kind of thing. They will be openly sexual in front of their kids. They won't shut and lock the bedroom door or wherever they're being sexual. They don't shut and lock it so the kids can walk in on them. They do it in such a way that it's so loud that it comes through the walls and the vents so the kids sit around and hear that. A very young child hearing that activity is usually quite frightened by it. It sounds like daddy's killing mommy or mommy's killing daddy. And it's real inappropriate to scare them that way and confuse them. With a family where there aren't sexual boundaries, there isn't any privacy in the bathroom, everybody's in there, all together, doesn't matter. People walk around the house nude, and everything is open, and that is considered healthy. Now, since I'm asking you not to ask questions, I'll just say a few things in here. I am not telling you that there is something wrong with nudity. It's really about this. When children reach a certain age and begin to notice that mom and dad are different and start really focusing in on that, one of the things that can happen to them is they can get overwhelmed in looking at the size of adult genitalia and breasts. You know, you forget that when a kid is little, when they look up at mom and dad, everything is even larger than what it is. And that can be real scary and overwhelming and shaming because when they check themselves out, they're so little compared to that big example. In addition to that, as the child ages, if nudity is allowed in the family, it isn't unusual when the child starts getting a lot of hormones on board and starts getting directly interested in sex and sexuality. What's going to happen if mom and dad continue to parade around nude, it won't be unusual for the child to start getting sexually stimulated by looking at the parents being nude. So you take a 12-year-old boy that's obviously having erections, masturbating, thinking a lot about girls, telling dirty jokes at school and all that sort of thing. Never forget when I first heard my brother do that. You know, I was this perfect little angel that wouldn't talk like that. And I had a brother 8 years younger. I remember getting on the phone one day, listening to him talk to Dougie. The conversation on the phone was unbelievable. You know, but anyway, where was I? I have a flash on that. What was I talking about? Somebody tell me what I
said.
Oh, yeah, take a 12-year-old boy. And Mom doesn't have boundaries. She walks around me, and she's sitting in the bathtub, and she says, "Hey, Harry, come in here. I want to talk to you." Now, she's not trying to flash him. She's trying to talk to him, but she's exposed. So Harry comes down, sits down on the toilet to look at her in the bathtub, notices her breasts, and starts getting an erection. That is abusive. Unintentional, but highly abusive and inappropriate behavior. Okay?
You're calling your daughter in if you're a woman is a totally different thing?
I think when a child is very... What the question was, if there are two members of the same sex involved, like a mother and a daughter, does the same thing hold? What I would tell you is when the child is really young, they could very easily get overwhelmed with your adult nude body. And I think it's just, I think it's most appropriate to not act like a prude about it, but to not expose them to that a lot. When the child gets a lot older, then if you have a good relationship and whatnot, for female to female or male to male, when the child is already developing and feeling adequate, then it isn't such a big hairy deal. But while they're growing, it is important. Slip of the tongue there. You have to use a good judgment. Like with my, I have a 22-year-old daughter, and I don't worry about that kind of thing, but of course with my son, no matter what age I am, I would never do that. And I didn't, never mind. The last kind of sexual abuse is called emotional sexual abuse. With this kind of abuse, there is no kind of sexual hands-on touching involved at all. This is, it's about emotional sexual abuse and not about any kind of physical abuse overt at all. This is quite hidden. One of the things that I teach people I'm working with to tell the difference between a functional family system and a dysfunctional family system is this, that a functional family system, within a functional family system, the adults are there to meet the needs of the children. In a dysfunctional family, the children are there to meet the needs of the adult. That is highly abusive and inappropriate. This emotional sexual abuse is one of the most glaring examples of that the children are there to meet the needs of the parents that I have. And this is highly abusive. With this kind of experience, what is going on is this, that you have two parents here. And functional family is the boundary between those parents and the children. There's a physical, sexual, emotional, and spiritual boundary system that protects these children from the very, very intimate details of this relationship. Kids only need to know about 80% of what's going on. The rest of it is called none of their business. Emotional sexual abuse happens when the parent or one parent draws the kid up into this relationship, and then the parent that's done that has a relationship with that child that's more important to the parent that has drawn them up than the spouse is. And what happens here is that the parent who has done this has the child that they have done it to meet their needs, meet the parent's needs. What's going on is that mom and dad are having trouble being intimate and meeting each other's needs. And if you've got two codependent people here who have been abused, they're not going to know how to be intimate. They're not going to know how to be in a relationship, and so they're in a relationship with their kids rather than being in a relationship with one another. And so they are emotionally intimate with those kids. And what they do is that the person who has done this to the child tells the child all about the intimate details of this relationship and how bad it is and how it's not working and what a jerk the other spouse is. And in doing that, they're dumping on the child emotions that they don't want to deal with, like anger and pain and fear and shame. And in addition to that, by doing that, they're asking the child to take care of them and be important to them where this other spouse won't be. This is extremely common to happen when there's an addict in the family, like maybe dad's an addict and mom's a codependent. Maybe dad could be a codependent too, but anyway, mom's the identified codependent, dad's the addict, dad is gone. Dad's a sex addict out in bars, having sex with other women, or a drug addict, or an alcoholic, out, or a work addict, out there doing something away from the family, never home to be intimate with mom. So mom winds up being intimate with her kids and using her kids. Sometimes the dynamics are seen a little differently. Sometimes two kids are drawn up in there, and dad takes one and mom takes the other. When this kind of thing happens, it's World War III between those two kids, because what happens is all the garbage that isn't dealt directly between mom and dad is fought out by the kids. Sometimes if there's only one kid in the family, you got two real sick codependent parents, they'll both do it to the child, which makes this poor child just crazy. but it also makes the child feel real powerful. Now, when the experience is a mother-daughter, the daughter is known as mommy's confidant, mom's caretaker. When it's mother's son, he's known as mommy's little man, mommy's surrogate husband. When it's father-daughter, she's known as daddy's little princess, daddy's surrogate wife. When it's father's son, he's known as daddy's little man. Well, this is a sneakier one. It's hard to see this father-son, but usually what happens here is that this is also going on, and what happens is that the father has the son take care of the dad by having the son take care of mom. It's like, you stand in for me. You take care of me by standing in for me. I'm too busy. I'm a work addict. I am gone. You take care of the family while I'm gone. So he's daddy's little man. Highly abusive. Kids aren't supposed to do that. They are supposed to be busy being kids. When this kind of thing happens to them, they never get a childhood. They're too busy being little adults, and their sexual roles as an adult their sexual identity and sexual roles get very confused when they become an adult. It isn't unusual, especially for some reason with mother-daughter, mother-son, for the child, when they grow up, to have sexual preference issues or sexual affectional preference issues, have trouble knowing what sex they are or what preference they have. And this will surface with, for example, like with a female. I'll use myself as an example because my mother emotionally sexually abused me. But it was dynamically different. She was an addict. And my dad was a work addict and gone, and my dad was absolutely unable to be intimate, because I thought that was all about him and nothing about my mom, so I wasn't deluded about my mom's drug addiction. So I would stay home and take care of mom, and I just really hated dad. And my dad kept giving me the message back that I was an ugly creep. You know, he didn't like me, because when a parent does this, it isn't unusual for this other parent to hate the kid. That's where they want to be. Or if mom's busy telling the kid that dad's a jerk, the kid's not going to like dad. They'll act that out, and then the dad won't like them. But anyway, the message I used to get back consistently from my father in the midst of this war between them was that I was a jerk and that I was ugly and that my being female was just absolutely without value. And that I, as a female, when I demonstrated that femaleness, was just worthless, because he hated me. And I grew up, I could not demonstrate my own femininity. I dressed and had a hairstyle that blended into the walls and had nothing feminine about it at all. And I had trouble later on learning how to dress and be feminine. I thought that was stupid, you know. But I think I just was smart that I thought it was stupid. I had no idea that I was being real dysfunctional. One of my issues of recovery is learning how to be a female, just looking like a female. And it was dreadfully painful learning how to do that. Going to the store and shopping, and, you know, it's a major miracle I can put a big earring on like that, because, you know, that'll attract you to looking at my face, and before I didn't want you to look at it. These are just very difficult issues, and this stuff is highly abusive, this emotional sexual abuse. Again, there doesn't have to be any hands-on touching here at all. But it isn't unusual for an incest, a child being incested to have also this going on, like being daddy's little girl, but also being incested by dad. I think one of the worst positions to be in is to be daddy's little girl. That is probably the most highly seductive experience in our culture, because men, by a lot, you know, by and by, it's changing, but are kind of more powerful than women. And to be daddy's little girl and be more important to daddy than mommy is just so powerful, so seductive. What happens to these women is they never find a man who would ever be what daddy was to them. And they, every man they're with, they are always comparing back to daddy. And of course, they're still little girls. They've never grown up. And so they act out all that little girl stuff and keep expecting a man to put up with that. Men that are healthy aren't going to do that. They might go crazy trying to somehow get this female to be there for them, but usually sets up disasters unless the woman marries an incest perpetrator, because she has her babies. She doesn't have sexual boundaries because they were destroyed with this stuff with dad. She's married an incest perpetrator, and he seduces her little girl, and she lives out the scenario backwards. Her daughter gets incested by her father, her husband, I mean. She winds up hating her child just like her mom hated her. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. Why? Because that's all she knows. She doesn't have the sexual boundaries to even know what's going on. Very, very unfortunate problems.
This is the end of Side 1. For more valuable information, turn cassette over now and continue to listen on Side 2. Do not fast forward.
The next kind of abuse I want to talk about is emotional abuse. Emotional abuse. It's after sexual abuse. Emotional abuse. Right? Am I screwing up? We've left sexual abuse. No, we just left sexual abuse. Now we're on emotional abuse. Now, the first kind of emotional abuse is verbal emotional abuse. This is probably one of the most intense forms of emotional abuse. And this kind of abuse happens from when the child gets attacked by somebody else's mouth. And it goes through their ears. They hear this stuff. It can happen with screaming, name-calling, where the child is called names, where a parent is discharging anger in a sneaky way called sarcasm, where the child is being ridiculed or made fun of, or just simply listening to a lot of that kind of activity going on in the family, but not getting it because they're so busy being perfect that they don't get it directly, but they have to sit around and listen to it happen to other family members. And it's just like watching or listening to physical abuse, listening to verbal abuse and watching it is just as abusive as to have it directed towards you. Another kind of emotional abuse is demanding perfection from a child. It's abusive to demand a child be something they cannot be. A child is imperfect. To teach them that to be perfect is to be normal, to teach them that the expectation is one of perfection, to maybe do it passively, like only model that without any direct mouthing of it, is highly abusive. It teaches the child to be unaware that they are imperfect so they can be accountable and spiritual as an adult. Highly abusive puts the child under great stress, and as the child is busy failing all the time, they're busy being shamed. And you grow up with this very, very distorted sense that you're failing all the time because you're not meeting this impossible mark. Then you shame yourself as an adult. Over-controlling a child is also an issue of emotional abuse. What that is about is this. When a child is born, they don't know who they are or how to do it. And what happens is that they, after a while, begin to notice what their parents are doing and who the parents are so they can get a sense of who they are and how to do it. They watch that a long time, and the parent encourages the child to mimic the behavior back. You know, they do it, now I want you to do it. And the parent will demonstrate it, and I ask the child to do it. somewhere between 18 months and 3 usually, the child will start having the sense that they want to do it their way. It's called the differentiation process. They've identified, now they want to differentiate and start doing it their way. If the parent does not allow the child to start that process and engage that process up until the time they're an adult, then the child is being over-controlled and the child's being emotionally abused. When a child is over-controlled and it is demanded that they only do exactly what the parent does and that anything else is unacceptable, the child never goes through that developmental process where they learn to feel good about doing things their way. They will, if it's done to the extreme, they won't have any idea what their way is, and they constantly have to wait for other people to tell them how to do it. And the other part of that is that they usually have a dreadful time being spontaneous or creative, and they're bound up. So highly abusive. I had this one. It was just awful, and I work against it all the time. Part of my working against it is come here and do this and be creative and stand on my feet and talk to you guys about this spontaneously. That I could not have done that 7 years ago. I would have just died for you to ask me a question, let alone for me to say, I don't know. And sometimes I say, I don't know. I'm working on it. I know that's a problem, but I don't know what to tell you. You know, I'm imperfect. But I don't understand the problem perfectly, because I don't. The next kind of abuse I put down here is social abuse. That's another form of emotional abuse. This is very, very common in addicted homes. But anyway, when a child grows up again, they look for mom and dad to figure out how to do it and who they are. They later look to their peers, their friends, to give them information about who they are and how to do it at their age. Sexual abuse happens whenever the parents either directly or indirectly interfere with the child's access to their peers. Direct interference is something like this. A parent saying to a child, this is a closed family system, you know, in other words, nobody's to come in this house. We don't want the neighbors to know what's going on in here. We don't air our dirty linen in public. No, you can't come, you can't bring your friends home. Furthermore, it's not safe out there. Don't go out there. Just stay with us, kid. We're all you need. Indirectly, it can happen this way. It could be that your parents are so out of control with their own addictions that you have to go home and take care of the family because they're not, so you don't have the time to go out and be with your peers because you're too busy being an adult in the family. It's like you come home and your mom's laying up drunk in the bedroom. She's not shopping. She's not cleaning the house. She's not taking care of your brothers and sisters or whatever. So you come home and you take over. You do the laundry. You clean the house. You make dinner, and you take care of mom. When that's going on, you don't have time to go out there and access your peers. There's no way you do, or it could be. But there's no rule, you can't bring anybody home, but you wouldn't bring anybody home no matter what. Because maybe dad's a sex addict and he's into trying to fondle your friends. Maybe dad's an alcoholic and you can't tell. He may be drunk on the living room couch when you come home, or mom may be drunk, or maybe mom's a sex addict and she tries to hustle your boyfriends when you bring them home. It isn't safe and they may shame you. Like, dad may be drunk and out of control. Dad may be a rage addict, a workaholic rage addict, and is... You never know when he's going to slap and punch you, and he does that in front of other people, and he does it in front of your friends. You don't bring anybody home because you don't know if dad's going to attack you and shame you in front of your friends. So it's about just not having the freedom to let your friends into your home and enjoy them, or go out and enjoy them out there. The other kind of abuse that's emotional that I want to talk to has to do with... neglect or abandonment issues. Now, I want to diagram this out because of all the issues of abuse, this is the one in our culture that needs to be looked at the most, especially when you're dealing with a codependent issue. Neglect, abandonment. When I tell people to look at this issue, I have them look at two different aspects of the issue. One, we're looking at how well your dependency needs were met as a child. Your dependency needs being food, clothing, shelter, physical nurturing. Medical and dental care in our culture now. meeting focal needs. And I really want to star this thing, focal needs. That's the child's need for time, attention, and direction. That really teaches them who they are in a positive way. When they get time, attention, and direction from a parent, it automatically says you're worthwhile. And the other thing, it teaches you how to do it the family way. You've got to get that in order to find out how to do anything. You need the time, attention, and direction from your parents. Neglect and abandonment has to do with how well these needs were met. Neglect means that they weren't well enough, and in the failing of that, you were shamed. But there was some attempt made at meeting them. Abandonment means that they simply were not met. Now that may be with the parent still in the home, because kids can be abandoned to addictions and still the parents still be in the home. So it may be the parent's in the home but has abandoned the family. But it may be about death or death through suicide, which is a massive issue of abuse. If you have a major caregiver suicide on you or attempt to suicide, you've got a major, major, major issue of abandonment to deal with. It could be from frank abandonment. You got up one morning, mom disappeared. Or you got up one morning, dad was gone. It could be through many abandonment experiences. I have a very good friend of mine talk about being abandoned by her mom on a routine basis. Mom had seven kids. It was a large Catholic family. Mom was totally out of control and shameless. Not only did she beat her children, and her main method of beating her kids was to use her spiked high heels. She would, as they were needy, she'd go out of control and beat them. And when that wouldn't work, she'd pack up her bags and walk out the door for two or three days at a time. Just leave them. So dad got home to start taking care of them. So it could be many abandonment experiences. But anyway, that's about that issue. The other thing you need to look at has to do with addictions. You need to assess if your major caregivers are addicts, like they were chemically dependent, or one of them was a sex addict, or both. One of them was a work addict, and work addiction is just as abusive and destructive to a child's development as any of these other addictions. But, and it's harder to deal with because our culture supports work addiction. But it's highly abusive to children because there's no way they get their focal needs met when dad or mom is a work addict. Chemical dependency, sex addiction, work addiction, religious addiction, codependency, folks. You're codependent, you're not really there for your kids. You're too wrapped up in your own stuff. I always miss a few. Let me see, I wrote them down before. Yeah, food addicts or gamblers. Food addictions or food disorders. You have a gambling addict. That's a sneaky one, too. Addictions impact neglect and abandonment issues. It has to do with the severity of the abuse as to whether you get abandoned or neglected. Two other things, too, that don't have anything to do with addictions, I don't think. If you have a crazy parent, you know, one that was out of touch with reality, or if you had a very, very physically ill parent, that was so physically ill they couldn't caretake you. You know, like your mom had polio and was a quadriplegic. She couldn't do it, but she was there, and you had to tend to her instead of her to you. My mom was crazy, going off to the mental institution every two or three months, or laying up in her bed in endless depressions that she couldn't get out of. You didn't get your dependency needs met. So when I ask people to look at neglect and abandonment, I make them write out all their dependency needs. I make them write out, take a look at all these issues of addictions and mental illness and physical illness, assess their family, major caregivers in terms of addictions, and then look at how each one of their dependency needs were met and whether any of those were not met, and I ask them to write about it. It has to do with neglect, abandonment, emotional abuse. That'll take you a few months. It takes about a year to get into recovery, working hard. It's good news, though. You'll feel better. The last kind of abuse I want to talk to you about is spiritual abuse. Now, some of you are already in 12-step programs. Yeah, and some of you aren't. For those who are I want you to listen to me for a minute. Those who aren't, you can ignore what I'm saying, those who aren't. If you're in a 12-step process and you've been spiritually abused, you're going to have a hard time working those and living those steps. So this issue of spiritual abuse is a very, very important one to pay attention to, because this one is very hidden and sneaky. It takes a lot of effort to really take a look at this kind of abuse issue. So for those of you who are in that, any one of those programs, SA, AA, OA, ACA, any of that stuff, pay attention. Normal functional families do two very, very important things for the children, actually three. The three things that they do is that they provide a set of rules for the kids to follow that are humanly possible to follow, and that they follow. This eventually becomes the child's value system. But the main thing about these rules is that they're very clear, that they're clearly stated, that the parents follow them and they're possible to follow. It actually doesn't matter what the rules are, just as long as there are some. So the child has a way of knowing and having a sense of what's right and what's wrong within their family system. The second thing a functional family does for their children is that the family, as the child develops their ability to think, that the family supports the child's thinking. So the child is given the message that their ability to think is okay and intact. And the child is allowed to challenge the thinking and the ideas of the adult. And the child's thinking is treated respectfully. It doesn't mean the parents always agree with the child's thinking or vice versa. It means that that isn't necessary. That it's okay for every individual, the family, to do their own thinking, and that that is supported. Now, when the child is thinking about a rule and they're flying in the face of a rule that's held valuable by the family, it doesn't mean that that's not confronted. But who the child is not attacked. And they're given a clear message that their thinking is in order. It's okay. It just needs some fine-tuning every now and then. The third thing a functional family does is provide a system of philosophy, a system of problem-solving for the child. They teach the child how to approach problems and work through problems. In addition to that, they teach the child that to have problems is normal. See, our culture does something screwed up. I think codependency is endemic in our culture, but the other crazy thing about it is that in our culture, not only are we supposed to be that one column I told you about, you know, above it all, we're taught that healthy people don't have problems. Now, that's kooky. Oftentimes in religious addicted families, they give this kind of crazy message that if you're right with God, you won't have problems, you won't be distressed, you'll be cool. Now, that's not humanly possible. That's ignorance and ridiculous. You know what I learned how to problem solve? I didn't get any of these things hardly met. I got plenty of food, clothing, and shelter, but I got nothing there, and I certainly was not given any kind of philosophy of living other than you should know how to do it. Why should I bother explaining? If you were okay, you know, you'd know without me telling you. That's abusive. Anyway, you know what I learned to problem solve? From my husband I'm married to now, Pat. He had to teach me, probably to save his own sanity, how to problem solve, and it was a dreadful experience for both of us. Thank God he knew how to problem solve. It's actually one of his fortes. When we look at spiritual abuse, we're looking at several different issues. It is abusive to live in a family where there aren't any rules, so life is chaotic, so there's nothing to follow. It is abusive to live in a family where the parents say, do as I say and not as I do. We don't have to follow the rules. We are above it. We're God and Goddess of the family. Don't you smoke as the parent sits there and smokes the third pack of cigarettes. It's also abusive to have a set of rules passed out, but they're hidden and not clear. They're covert. They're never spoken to. It's also abusive to be given a set of rules that are antisocial or skewed and crazy. So in terms of rules, there's all that. In terms of thinking, it's spiritually abusive whenever a child has their thinking attacked and they're not allowed to do their own thinking and they're not supported in their own thinking process, even when it differs from the parents. You know, when my kids differ, if their idea is different from mine, I allow them to have different ideas, but they still have to follow my rules. They're not attacked for thinking differently. I say, yes, I can see you don't agree with me on that, but you are going to do it because you're living under my roof. Now, see, as long as I acknowledge that they're differing and it's okay to differ, but we're still going to go to the market, Daniel, whether you want to go or not, we are going to the market because I'm not leaving you here alone. You know, I still follow through, but I don't attack him as being a creep because he doesn't want to go to the market. That's his idea. I don't want to go. I don't attack him for that. I say, I hear you. I understand that. You want to stay home and watch cartoons, but we have to go to the market, and you're not old enough to stay here alone in this house. The third thing about religious abuse, again, has to do with philosophy. When you're not given any way problem-solving techniques, or the techniques you're given are skewed or antisocial, then you're being abused and abused spiritually. And if you're taught the way to problem solve is to no matter what prevail, and if you have to lie, cheat, and steal, do it, that's how you problem solve, and you're being taught how to be antisocial, you're likely to get in a whole lot of trouble as an adult, and that's abusive. That's teaching you how to be better than, that's teaching you that you are better than, that you can play God and havoc in other people's life and your poop doesn't smell. And that's being spiritually abusive. And here's the last one. I want you to really listen to this carefully. This happens, you know, within my recovery from my own chemical dependency issues, I see this one going along a lot for people. And it goes like this. I wish I had written it out for you. I just haven't written it out, but follow this carefully. Whenever a child is physically, sexually, or emotionally abused by a parent or a surrogate parent, or a religious person, like a nun, a priest, a Sunday school teacher, or a minister, the child is not only being physically, sexually, and emotionally abused, in addition to that, they're being spiritually abused. Because what's happening is this. Usually in most families in our culture, there's a concept of the higher power. Then there's the abusive parent, and then there's the child. When a child is being emotionally, sexually, or physically abused by the parent, what essentially the parent is doing is leaning over the child and saying this, I am better than you are, and I can do whatever I goddamn well want to do to you. I'm perfect, and I'm God or Goddess of the family. And I'm above you, and you're going to do what I say, and I don't care what you think. When they do that, they are vaulting and setting themselves up on the throne. Now, the only entity that needs to be up on that throne is the child's higher power. I define, for codependence, I define a higher power, a concept of a higher power, is a power that's greater than you are, but also greater than your parents. And you'll find 9 times out of 10... Most codependents have been highly spiritually abused, and one of the problems is that mom and dad or both are on the throne. That who's the higher power for the codependent is mom and dad, and then they put their spouse up there too after they get married. This is unusual. Or if they don't put their spouse up there, they're over being arrogant, grandiose. They got mom and dad on the throne, and they're sitting on the throne too, and everybody else is down below. And that's because of that experience, the parent saying, I'm here and you're there. And the child, as a codependent adult, will keep them there through hate, and I want you to notice, hate, worship, or fear. That needs to be therapeutically intervened on.
Would that be the church up there?
Hmm?
Would that be the church up there?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the church up there. This happens a lot, especially with religious addicted parents. Can you imagine the distress a child gets into when a religious caretaker physically, sexually, emotionally abuses them? I want to tell you something. I don't know if it's just because of where I work, because we treat a lot of sick people. Nobody comes to where I work because they're so well. And I'm not saying that I'm above it all, because I've certainly been in those trenches and I'm bit, you know, out a little bit. But anyway, I want to tell you one thing that kind of goes hand in glove is when we get a sick religious leader in there, 9 times out of 10, they're also a sex addict. There's a lot of people who dress in black with a white collar that are hiding sex addiction within that vestige. And they're doing that because when, as a religious leader, they get into being asked to caretake other people, so there's a lot of real vulnerable people coming to them, and they can stand there and do that and act out their sex addiction in safety because nobody would think that anything like that is going on. So don't, I want to tell you just from my experience, not only in chemical dependency, but in codependency treatment and eating disorder treatment and all this other stuff, I can't tell you how many people write about being sexually abused by spiritual leaders or religious leaders, male and female religious leaders, a lot of sneaky stuff that goes down like that. Or doctors or counselors or therapists or, you know, people that stand in the helping professions. There's one other thing I want to tell you in regards to abuse that I want you to note. I've mentioned major caregiver or major caretaker a lot. And I want to tell you who that is. Most of the time we're referring to parents or surrogate parents, foster parents, step-parents, and those kind of people. Or grandparents or step-grandparents or foster grandparents or those kind of people. But other people that might have abused you, you need to be writing about also, such as older siblings, aunts, uncles, cousins, you know, other family members. It could be a minister, or it could be a priest, or it could be a nun, or it could be a babysitter, or a scout leader, or a coach. Some of the grossest issues of sexual abuse I have a lot of men tell me about is at the hands of a coach. A lot of real sneaky physical sexual abuse that goes on in those locker rooms. Coach. So there's lots of, and it could be strangers, people that leave. You know, when you're little, you are weaker, you're vulnerable. And a lot of people can be set up to get you. That's why it's real important for parents to be very, very, very aware of that kind of thing and protect you until you get old enough to protect yourself. So when we talk about major caretakers, and I'm asking you to assess issues of abuse, look at that whole spectrum of people. And how to inventory that is to start doing list work on your history that was abusive. You need to state in one column what kind of abuse it was. Was it physical, sexual, emotional, or spiritual? You need to make a brief description of what happened. You don't need to write 10,000 pages on it. All you have to do is write it down so that if you repeated it back to someone, they could get a picture of it. And you need to state who did it. Was it Mom? Was it Dad? Was it Father Brown? Was it Dr. So-and-so? You know, was it a counselor Mom sent you to or whatever, a coach? And then you need to talk about what feelings you had as a child when it happened and what feelings you have now as you're thinking about it, if you know. It isn't unusual for a codependent not to know what the feeling reality is. And that's how you do list work to begin to get your history straightened out. And that is the end of this lecture.